The following is an encore presentation of an interview originally aired February the 5th, 2012 for American History Month.
On the Bookshelf with your host, Dave Doc Kirby.
February is American History Month, and what more interesting thing can we talk about than the creation of the American West? A lot of the activity took place in two critical years, 1846 to 1847. To talk to us more about that is Winston Groom, best-selling author of 15 previous books, including Vicksburg, 1863, Patriotic Fire, Shrouds of Glory, Conversations with the Enemy, which was a Pulitzer Prize finalist, Forrest Gump, which is probably in his latest book, Kearny's March, The Epic Creation of the American West, 1846 to 1847. It's from Knopf Books, and Winston Groom lives in Point Clear, Alabama, but is traveling around doing publicity for the book, and we had a chance to talk with him. Winston, it's wonderful to have you on the Bookshelf today.
Well, thank you. It's great to be here.
One of the things that I always enjoy about your books, I always learn something. And one of them is that this is really the story of four parallel journeys that were taking place in 1846 and 47. Three of them involved the U.S. military. One of them involved a guy more famous for being an explorer than a military leader. One of them involved a Mormon brigade. And the private party that ended up badly was the Donner Party. But all four of these guys apparently were on their way west simultaneously. I find that a pretty interesting juxtaposition of history.
Well, there was a lot going on in that year. I didn't realize it, of course. And I'll tell you, I think normally I'd like to be able to go out. Well, I say I'd like to, maybe I wouldn't. But to go out to the audience and speak to them and say, look, I have been working on this great notion for 30 years, and I've explored all the venues and avenues of it, and now I'm going to write my book. But that's not the way I generally do things. I call it sort of an a posteriori way, which means I stumble into them. And in Kearny's March, I was actually, a few years back, I was looking up General Philip Kearny, who was killed in the Shenandoah Valley during the Civil War. And by mistake, I came across General Stephen Kearny and discovered that he was General Philip Kearny's uncle. And then I saw some paragraph there that began Kearny's March. And I thought, you know, that's a good title for a book. I started looking more and more into what he did, and it really, not just him, I think the march itself was symbolic in a lot of ways, but it was extraordinary, too. But there are two things I think that you can sort of take away from this book, which is that when General Stephen Watts Kearny marched out of Fort Leavenworth, Kansas, on that beautiful June day in 1846 with something called the Army of the West, which was 2,000 mounted troops to go to all the way down 1,000 miles down the Santa Fe Trail and take Santa Fe, wherever General Kearny went became the United States of America, and he went all the way to California. And that is basically how we had either the acquisition or the theft of the American West, depending on your point of view. And the second thing I think should be taken away from this book is that from the moment General Kearny marched out of Fort Leavenworth, there were some unintended consequences, which was it. That began the first phase, political phase, of the Civil War, because the forces against slavery, the abolitionists, quickly realized that as General Kearny and the Americans conquered and took new territories, that the Southerners were going to want to have those, not all, at least some of those territories, as slave states. And the reason for that was not so much that they wanted to expand slavery, but there had always, in the U.S. Congress, the North was very, very populous and outnumbered the South in congressmen. But in the Senate, North and the South are basically 50-50, and there had been generally a gentleman's agreement that when the U.S. took in a free state, then they would take in a slave state, and vice versa. For instance, when they took in Texas, they also, as a slave state, they took in Maine. The reason for that was so that the balance of the Senate, which actually controlled, obviously, the politics of the nation, would be equal. the South wanted to extend. I mean, in other words, if the territories came in and became free, then the South wanted to have forever free territory, slave territory, so they would feel like they were represented. So those are really the sort of the two main themes of the story.
Now, there was a fair amount of controversy over the war with Mexico at the time. I remember reading that, of course, Mexico was a much newer nation than the United States, but they had a huge army. They had one of the largest armies in the world. But on the other hand, they were not exactly a stable democracy. In fact, the guy that we ended up facing. Now, there was a pretty interesting story of how Santa Anna, who fought 10 years ago and slaughtered the inhabitants and the defenders of the Alamo and was defeated. Now, 10 years later, he's coming back into power. And apparently the United States is kind of behind the scenes helping to work him into place because for some idiotic reason, we decided that now he was going to be trustworthy and he was going to play fair with us. And of course, Santa Anna was one of the most corrupt politicians in a pretty corrupt nation, and he always looked out for himself.
He tricked us. He tricked President Polk, and he tricked everybody else. But he was a tricky guy.
Yes.
The problem of Mexico, when they separated from the Spanish, they overthrew the Spanish in a revolution in the 1820s, and during the 20 or so years between then and 1846, they had like 30 or so governments, and most of them by armed revolution. I mean, Mexico was in the state of eternal war with these generals who were mostly the politicians, and they were not only unstable, they were broke, and they owed the United States a great deal of money. But the Mexicans, I mean, Santa Anna had been the, I think this was his, would be his fifth term, I mean, on and off. And he was a militant guy who, used his army to control things. But what happened was that in the previous administration of Santa Anna was so bad that they exiled him under pain of death to come back to Mexico. He sent him to Cuba. And he sent an emissary to President Polk, James K. Polk, who was the President of the United States in 1846, and the emissary told President Polk that Santa Anna would intercede in the Mexican War or the possibility of a Mexican War if only he could be returned safely to Mexico. And so Polk interceded indeed and told his Navy that if a ship came from Cuba carrying General Santa Anna, to let it go on. And he did. And, of course, the minute Santa Anna set foot on Mexican soil, he got up an army and went to fight the Americans. He went back on everything. But that is probably to be expected of this kind of man. He was indeed corrupt.
We're talking, in case you're just joining us, to Winston Groom, who's the author of Kearny's March, The Epic Creation of the American West, 1846 to 1847, from Knopf Books. Another thing about this book that I really found fascinating was we tend to think of those presidents between, say, Jackson and Lincoln as being rather deserving of the more or less anonymity in which they have sunk. But Polk is one who's a lot more interesting now that I've read your book than I realized. And you seem to expose a side of him that I don't even know if he would have recognized, and that was that he was a man of great vision for the future of the United States. He had an agenda to accomplish, and he did it in one term.
Well, he did indeed. And as a matter of fact, he said he was going to serve one term, and that was going to be that. And when he began his term, he sat down for some reason, just a conversation with his Secretary of the Navy, Bancroft, and told him the four things that I want to accomplish while I'm the president. The first was to get rid of the National Bank. This was something that Andrew Jackson had hated, if any historians remember, which is sort of akin to the Fed. But Polk wanted to get rid of this thing because he thought it was corrupting. And the second thing he wanted to do was to reduce or get rid of what was known as the Tariff of Abominations, which had nearly caused a split in the nation when it was levied back in the 1830s. It was a tariff that was unfair to the South and caused a great deal of acrimony. And he said the third thing he wanted to do was to get rid of the British out in the Northwest, in Oregon. And Oregon at that point was comprised not just of what is now the state of Oregon, but also what is now the state of Washington and parts of Montana and Idaho. It was huge. And the British and the Americans had a joint interest in this area. And the British were making bellicose noises about war and so forth if the Americans wanted too much. But Polk faced them down and wound up with the boundary basically where it is today. You know, it's just sort of that looping line that goes from the Midwest out to Puget Sound, and everything north of there is Canada, and everything south of there is America. So the fourth thing he said he wanted was California, and he wanted to buy it, I mean, from the Mexicans, and it is. Premise was, I mean, all that territory, he thought that America should be a nation from sea to shining sea. I mean, he took a look at the map when he became president, and he didn't like what he saw on the map. He saw, you know, a big East and a big what is now the Middle West, but so there it stopped. And the immigrants were pouring into the country. He thought it needed to be bigger, and he was willing to pay for it. The Mexicans had nearly abandoned those territories. California, see, they weren't Mexican states, they were Mexican territories. And the Mexicans, because they were broke, couldn't furnish money for an army to go up and protect the citizens from the depredations of the wild Indians. And so this presented a big problem. And Polk thought, well, you know, we can be of some assistance there. And Mexico could relieve itself of some of its debts, but we'll pay them many millions of dollars, which of course is many, many billions today. But the Mexicans refused. Well, actually, one president was going to talk to the Americans about it, and he was thrown out of office for the very notion of talking to the Americans. I mean, the Mexican War is, nobody will really ever know the truth about it. There's a lot of thought that we started it, but what happened actually was that when the Congress of the United States voted to allow Texas to become a state, the Mexicans said, this will be a war. We're not going to allow Texas to be a state. And they stationed an army down on the Rio Grande River, and we stationed an army on the other side of the river. And invariably, their army came over and savaged one of our cavalry patrols, and that was the pretext for the war. All of the efforts of President Polk to purchase Mexico went for naught. He sent an emissary down there, and the Mexicans refused to see him. But it was essentially a land grab. War is war, though. I mean,
all right.
When you have a war, it's not like, you know, you're going to negotiate it. And I don't really, in my book, I'm not into this sort of guilt trip sort of thing where Americans are expected to show eternal remorse for all the things that we have done. I think I present all the facts and let the reader figure out what it is. There's enough blame to go around, but I mean, I don't know. We're not going to give it back.
Right. So we did pay for it, which, you know, there we did pay for it too. And there have been few nations in world history who ever defeated another nation, taken territory from them, and then said, oh, and by the way, here's a check for the stuff we just got from you. That's fairly unheard of.
Well, I mean, you got to look at it this way. It was a long time ago, and first of all, I mean, the Mexicans got it from the Spanish when they overthrew the Spanish. You know, they stole it from the Spanish, who had stolen it from the Indians,
right?
Who had stolen it from the wild animals. Who, and I expected the wild animals had stolen it from things like water bugs and rattlesnakes and whatever. So, I mean, it all of the evolution of taking of this land, go back far enough, you'll discover that somebody else owned whatever it is, including the land in the shale you're sitting in right now.
Yeah, yeah. And you, the argument might be made that a lot of Mexicans are coming north to live in areas that if we hadn't bought it from them, they would have been able to live in anyway. Another thing about this movement westward that occurred in 1846 is that you have a guy who is more known as a sort of a celebrity of his day. Fremont is one of the best-known guys in America.
Yeah, this is a fascinating guy. He was the bastard son of a Virginia belle who was stolen away from her elderly wealthy husband by a French fencing and ballet teacher who removed her to Charleston, where they had Fremont, and then he promptly died and left the family in reduced circumstances. And Fremont was a brilliant young guy, but he was a terrible student. But he, fortunately for himself, fell in with an engineer who was what they call a topographical engineer for the Army, who taught him his trade. And these guys that were topographical engineers were really jacks of all trades. I mean, they were astronomers. They had to be, because they were mountain makers, and they fixed positions everywhere. They did things like they measured the height of mountains by going up the mountain and boiling water, see what temperature the water boiled at. They were botanists, and they were flora and fauna, everything that they could record when they went out. And what Fremont did, he had three explorations. He took these mountain men who were really famous in their own day too, guys like Kit Carson and Basil Legendez, and these were real tough old trappers who had run out of a trade because somebody discovered that silk was just as good and a lot cheaper than beaver skin to make a top hat. These old trappers had been out west, and Fremont, I mean, they made actually the first explorations of the west, the first white man's exploration. They couldn't have told you where they were. Fremont could, but Fremont took astrological measurements every so many miles and actually put all this stuff on a map. And he was called a pathfinder. Really sort of, well, actually he was. He found somebody else's path.
Right. He didn't make the path. He just found somebody else's.
He didn't make it. I think the historian Nevins suggested he should be called a path marker. But whatever it is, he not only went out and explored all of the West, and I'm talking about now Colorado and Nevada and Utah, and no, I mean, these were so remote places that the majority of Americans call this the Great American Desert, which that's where it appeared on the map, and they thought there was nothing out there that would grow and nothing out there but Indians. And Fremont not only explored it all and mapped it all, when he came back, he wrote a lengthy account of it with the assistance of his wife, who had a flair for writing, and she was lucky enough to have been born the daughter of the most powerful man in the U.S. Senate, Thomas Hart Benton, who had this Fremont's account published by the government printing office, which, of course, was free. And that allowed it to be picked up in all the newspapers. And Fremont became, within a short period of time, the most famous man in America. He was like, John Glenn, one of these first astronauts. Explorers were very, very high on everybody's list back then. Of course, now there's not much to explore. But Fremont, I mean, there are streets named after him in towns and whatever. But he was a young guy, and he's very ambitious. And he got himself in a sling out in California. He said that when he went west on his second expedition, that he was carrying secret orders from President Polk to go to California and, if possible, take it for the United States. And there's been a historical dispute about all that, whether he had these orders, whether he didn't have these orders, but whatever it was, that's what he did. Mm-hmm. At least he helped do.
Right.
And but he got in trouble with General Kearney, who was marching the other way, which is the whole Southwest way. When Kearney left Santa Fe after conquering it, he marched 1,000 miles through completely uncharted territory with his smaller army. I mean, there was no maps or anything. This was across the Southwest deserts, and he wound up, as soon as he got to California, he got in a fight with the Mexicans and was nearly wiped out. But he survived and became the governor of California, and got in a terrible argument with Fremont about who was the governor. Fremont said he was a governor, but Kearney was a general, and Fremont was a colonel by this point. And colonels don't go around telling generals what they are. Fremont made I think a very big mistake, because Kearney marched him back to Washington and court-martialed him in the most famous trial of the century, really. It eclipsed almost all the news of the Mexican War, and I'm not going to reveal how that trial turned out.
Right.
Fremont was facing the wrong end of a rope for things
yeah.
like mutiny and so forth. But there was a lot going on that those years, 1846 and 1847. People moving everywhere.
And then you have this group, Brigham Young, taking the Mormons away from the United States territory, hoping to take them out into a wilderness of their own outside the reach of the United States, and they settle in Utah, and dun-dun-dun, it becomes U.S. territory.
Had a rough time in America. Part of it was that in those days they practiced polygamy, and that didn't set too well with the Methodists and the Baptists, and the little ladies got mad and stirred their husbands up, and so the Mormons were abused and chased out of practically everywhere they went, and actually their leader was murdered, and Brigham Young took over. He's the most one that everybody remembers as being the leader of the Mormons, and Young was, they said, he's going to lead them out of U.S. territory, and did, in fact, went to Salt Lake and looked around and liked what he saw, and they started this colony out there that ultimately it was a huge migration. It was 75,000 people, which was a lot of people back then.
Mm.
And of course now in the beginning there were just several thousand of these Mormons, and now they're millions worldwide. Salt Lake City is more or less the center of all this. But then there was a Donner Party, which was extremely tragic. Interesting in a way, though, because most of the people who immigrated west, did so because they were, you know, they were poor. They couldn't make a living where they were. The land was too expensive or something. Donners and their party actually were fairly well-off people, but they decided they were grass was greener somewhere, and they made the mistake of accepting the vision of a man called Lansford Hastings, who was sort of he modeled himself on Sam Houston out in Texas. He was sort of the father of Texas. And Hastings wanted to be the father of California, meaning that he wanted to establish some entity out there and be the king and the president or whatever, and he figured there's a lot of money in it. So he wrote this pamphlet in book size that he distributed all over the country, extolling the values of California, but saying that there was a shorter way by 500 miles that he had found called the Hastings Cutoff. It would, and I guarantee if you save 500 miles by wagon train, it's a great thing. And the trouble was that Hastings had never been down this cutoff. It turned out that it was viable if you were just a man or team of people on horseback, but not for these big wagons. The end result was that the Donner Party were too late to get over the mountains, the Sierras, which are enormous mountains, 19,000 feet and up, you know, big. There was a pass at 7,000 feet. And these mountains, of course, are like a great wall for 500 or 600 miles from Canada down to toward Mexico. And they got up the pass only to find it being clogged with snow. It was an enormous snowstorm that lasted day after day. And they wound up, the whole party of them, 80 or 90 of them, stranded up there. They couldn't get down either side. And they had to settle for staying for the winter until the snow melted. And they simply did not have the provisions to last. People knew they were up there, but they couldn't reach them. I mean, they sent a small team up there of two Indians with some mules with food, and the Donners they ate the food, and then they ate the mules, and then they ate the Indians.
Right. They did choose badly, and they never should have taken a shortcut, which is a cautionary tale. But they certainly were willing to be innovative. And that's why
the biggest mistake I think they made personally is that they didn't take a certified mountain man with them, because a mountain man would have said, first of all, it's too late. Well, he would have scouted up there first and made sure that you could get across that pass. And the second thing is that they had, like all these immigrants, they had cattle trains with them to feed themselves along the way, because it's not like you can stop at a McDonald's out there.
Right.
But the Indians had picked off a lot of the cattle, most of them, in fact. But when they got to the pass, though, they still had a few cattle, and they had their mules and their horses. But when the snowstorm came, they just sort of turned these livestock loose, and the livestock, the snow covered them up, and they never found them again. So this mountain man would have killed them immediately.
Yeah.
And we, they would have known where they were. But the Donna spent, the entire time with long poles trying to, I mean, the snow up there can be 15, 20 feet deep.
Mm.
It's astonishing. You can see, if you go there, they chop down trees to, firewood, and they chop down trees 15 feet. You can see where the ash marks is. The stuff is 15 feet tall all over, because that's how high the snow was.
Wow.
It's a very, very dangerous place in the wintertime up there. It was. I mean, it still is, actually, if you do
yeah.
things. But back then, it wasn't like there was an interstate highway going across it.
Right. Well, Winston, I wanted to mention also something I got to review, not from Knopf, but from history.com and A&E TV, and that is a documentary that came out this year called Lee and Grant, and you are the writer and the executive producer of that. I just finished reading that, and I'll be sending a review out on that one as well. And my understanding is that you're working on a book about the Battle of Shiloh that's going to be published on the 150th anniversary, which is this coming April.
That's true. That was a Shiloh. I had a deadline. First time I had a deadline since I was in the newspaper business 30 years ago.
The 150th anniversary is going to fall on the day that the battle occurred, and that's all there is to it.
Yeah, April 6th, 1862, and that's 2012 will be the April 6th, 2012 will be the 150th anniversary. Susquehcentennial. I can't say the word. I don't know why somebody invented such a word.
We'll stay in touch, because I want to talk to you about that book as well.
Absolutely, I would be delighted. This has been painless and fun.
Glad to hear it.
The eyesight isn't the best. I mean, you get old, everything starts to fall to pieces. Can't see, can't hear, can't think.
But your ability to tell a great story is still intact, and we're grateful for that. We've been talking to Winston Groom, who's the author of Kearney's March, The Epic Creation of the American West, 1846-1847, from Knopf Books. That's in case you're wondering, that's K-N-O-P-F. It's available everywhere. Winston Groom, of course, is the author of lots and lots of wonderful books, not the least of which is Forest, which is going to be coming out a nice collectible edition, apparently, from Vintage Anchor around Valentine's Day. So be looking for that as well. Thank you so much for being with us on The Bookshelf, and we look forward to the next time we get a chance to talk.
Well, it's a pleasure.
Our special thanks to Winston Groom for joining us today on The Bookshelf. And once again, we invite you to look for his documentary, Lee and Grant, from the History Channel A&E, was the writer and the executive producer of, as well as his new book, Kearney's March, and his other books that are going to be available, and be looking for them. And we will be talking to Winston again about the Battle of Shiloh, the sesquicentennial coming up in April of 2012. Thanks so much for joining us on The Bookshelf. We'll see you next time right here on your favorite radio station. Until then, I'm your host, Dave Doc Kirby, and God bless.